The views and opinions expressed on the following program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Absolute Broadcasting, its staff, or advertisers. It's time for Israel is Real. Two Israelis putting a human face on all things Israel. Rahel and Sonia focus on life in modern 21st century Israel, telling the stories of ordinary people living in, loving, and in support of an extraordinary land. Israel is Real is a community-supported program featuring interviews with local, national, and international celebrities, personal life stories, and call-ins. Learn a new Hebrew word every week. Israel is Real. Every Friday on 1590 WSMN. Nashua's News and Talk. And now, your hosts, Rahel and Sonia.
Hi, we're Rahel.
And Sonia.
And this is Israel is Real. Boker Tov lekol ha-mazinim.
Tzoraim Tovim b'Yisrael.
From WSMN 1590, Nashua's News and Talk. Today, we have a very special guest, and we're going to give our guest all the time in the world, so we are going to cut right to the guest. I'm going to tell you a little bit about him. Dr. Mordechai Kedar is an Israeli scholar of Arabic literature. He's an expert on Arab and Muslim culture and thought, and a lecturer at Bar Ilan University in Israel, Tel Aviv, where he also received his PhD. He has served in the Israel Defense Force military intelligence for 25 years, where he specialized in Islamic groups, the political discourse of Arab countries, the Arabic press and mass media, and also the Syrian domestic arena. And Dr. Kedar drew world attention with a June 2008 Al Jazeera interview, which I hope you have seen, in which he challenged the moderator, pointing out that Jerusalem was never mentioned in the Quran. This is the first installment of a three-part series on Arabic language and Islamic culture. It's pre-recorded, and we will bring you right away, Dr. Mordechai Kedar.
We have invited you because you are an expert on the Arabs, on the Arab and Islamic society, community, culture, politics, language, and thought. And first of all, maybe before we get started, you could tell us, how did you achieve this expertise? How did you become interested in Islam, and what motivated you?
Let me start with a little biographical detail. I was born to parents who came from Poland to Eretz Israel in the 30s. And my mother tongue is Yiddish. So Arabic is not my language. However, I studied Arabic in high school, and I had a magnificent teacher who taught us not only the language, but also to look at the culture which talks in this language, which is the Arabic and the Islamic culture. And he very successfully implanted in our souls the love to explore these societies and this culture by reading its literature, by being exposed to its media, by listening to people, by reading whatever they can write. And he actually made us, I would say, thirsty and hungry to know more about Arabic society and about Islamic society. This was a major success because most of our students in the high school in Tel Aviv went later to the intelligence using their skills in Arabic and their thirst to know more about the Arab world, which is the basic characteristic of somebody who wants to succeed in the intelligence. So after 25 years of trying to understand the Arab world through texts, which we read in the intelligence, I continued this attempt to understand this world in the academia since I was released from the army in the mid-90s. So altogether, more than 40 years, I deal with the Arab world, with the Arab society, with Islamic discourse, with Islamic texts, with Friday sermons, with mass media in the Arab world, and I would even say the culture in large meaning of this word. So this is actually my background in Arabic. And since I love it, I do it all the time. Even when I go in my car, I listen to Arabic radio stations. And this exposure to this Arabic, whatever I can intercept, actually brought me to know whatever I know about this world. And I'm not attempting to say that I know everything.
So you are actually fluent in Arabic, right?
Yes, I'm fluent in Arabic. And I would even say that my Arabic, my literal Arabic, is better than my English. So you might have some sense of the Arabic which I master. And there are here and there on the internet some clips where I speak in Arabic, and everyone can see. And you know, even our neighbors, even those who do not like us Israelis, they do appreciate the fact that an Israeli is speaking fluent Arabic, especially right. literary Arabic.
Right.
Because it's some kind of dignifying side of correspondence. When you talk to these indigenous people, wherever they are, in their own language, at least you talk from the same height of the eyes. You don't patronize them. They don't feel that they are humiliated by you, since you speak in their language. They don't, you know, as you, I don't know if you know, but the Indians, from the history of the British occupation in India, the Indians felt humiliated, especially because the Brits were addressing them in English, not in their own languages.
We're going to ask you to start teaching us a little bit of Arabic, if you don't mind, and maybe we can start with the word Islam and the word Salam. Those two words as a starting point. What would you tell us about them?
Well, whenever you listen today to those who speak for Islam, claim time and again that Islam is based on the word salam, means shalom, peace, and actually this is a religion of peace and hugs and kisses to all the world. This is what they keep saying. However, I think, and many others think, that this is some kind of deception. The word Islam means submission. Submission of the human being to the willing of Allah. Nullifying his own wills and accepting the wills of Allah as formulated in his holy book, in the Quran, and in his Sharia, means the what we say in Hebrew, halakha, the Islamic law of how to behave in every situation in life. This is actually Islam, when the human being accepts all the verdicts of Allah and directs its behavior, its wills to what Allah wants him to do. And this is what Islam is. And when I'm talking about human being, I'm talking about the individual, and the group, and the family, and the society, and the state, and the whole mankind. All mankind are demanded by Islam to accept Islam as the only way how to worship Allah. All the people should abandon all the idol-worshipping religions, and of course also Judaism and Christianity, because Islam in its own view came to the world to replace all the religions, especially Judaism and Christianity, not to live side by side with them. And here we come to the word salam. So what is salam? Means shalom, means peace, according to Islam. Salam means peace. We reign the world after the whole world will accept Islam as the formula for life for all mankind. Principally, there cannot be peace between the Islamic State and other states which have not yet accepted Islam, the infidel states. Principally, there can be only permanent war, jihad, between the Islamic entity and all the other entities. So, well, not always they can do it, and there are some kind of precedence how Islam can deal with other states when Islam cannot defeat them. But in the matter of principle, Islam cannot tolerate any other entity which is not Islamic. And this is why they divide the world to Dar al-Harb and Dar al-Salam, means the house of war and house of peace. While all the countries, all the states which accepted the Islam are the house of peace, all the other states which have not yet accepted Islam are the house of war, Dar al-Harb. So the word Islam and Salam are connected to only in the sense that Salam means peace will prevail in the world when all the world will be Islamic world. This is what really Salam means, especially peace between communities who live side by side in peaceful terms under the Islamic rule. In a matter of fact, Islam can temporarily accept Jews or Jewish communities and Christian communities who can live under the Islamic rule temporarily until they embrace Islam. And as long as they do not embrace Islam, they should pay the skull tax, which is called the jizya. Especially, according to the Quran, they should pay the jizya when they are humiliated because they did not yet adopt Islam. So as long as they stick to their false religions, Judaism and Christianity, they should pay the jizya while being humiliated, according to a verse in the Quran. But still, if they pay the jizya, the Islamic State can provide them with security, both to their lives and to their belongings. And they pay for this protection which the Islamic State provides them. And they can be tolerated as long as they behave according to the Islamic Sharia, especially in the public sphere. Means that a woman, a Jewish woman, a Christian woman, cannot walk around in the streets exposed without hijab, especially on her head, on her hair.
The hijab is the covering.
The covering, right. Because she cannot seduce the men, if she goes too exposed in the public sphere. A Jew and a Christian cannot sell wine in the public sphere to people who are not Jewish and Christians, because this will lead the Muslims astray from the Sharia, from the Halakha, from the Islamic rule. So, and so forth, Jews and Christians can be tolerated as long as they live under Islam according to the Islamic rules. Their houses cannot be taller than Islamic houses. A synagogue and a church cannot be taller than mosque. And in some countries, Islamic countries, in some times, Jews and Christians were forced to wear a yellow, Jews were forced to wear a yellow sign, and Christians a sign in an orange color. And this is actually the origin of this issue, which we found again in the 30s and the 40s in Central Europe. It started in the 9th century in Baghdad, the capital of the Abbasid dynasty. So this is actually what Islam is. Islam is submission, being submitted to Allah, to His rules, to His verdict, to His prescription for life, which should be the way of conduct for all people in the world.
I have a question. Yeah. When Jewish people and Christians are living in under the Islamic law, are they equals Are they living as equals?
Not at all. A Jew and a Christian cannot sue a Muslim in front of Sharia court, which is the only court which can be there.
What is the Arabic word for this concept?
The concept is that Jews and Christians are submitted to Islamic law. And since they have no status in the Islamic state, they cannot be members of the community, full members, who can take the Muslim to a court. This, the Muslim has immunity to this thing. And actually this what caused some kind of harassment and exploitation of Jews and Christians, especially when it comes to girls, Jewish girls and Christians as well, who in many Islamic countries were kidnapped at the age of 12 to 13, 14 by Muslims and forced to get married to them. As you might know, a Muslim can marry a Jewish or a Christian lady without her being converted to Islam.
Huh?
Kitabiyah. She is, from the from Ahle Kitab, those who have books. So, but a Muslim girl has no option to get married to a Jewish man or Christian man. Muslim men can take and marry Jewish women and, of course, Christians as well. So, this, again, demonstrates the inequality of Jews and Christians on one side and Muslims on the other side, and there are many other demonstrations of this inequality.
What's dhimmi?
The whole system is called the al-dhimma. Means those people who live under the auspice of Islam. And this is actually what I was talking about the Jews and Christians who can live under Islamic, or the rules of the Jews and Christians, which arrange the life of those communities under the Islamic rule. And of course, there is kind of a contract. On one side, they pay the jizya, the scout tax, and on the other side, they are protected in their lives and belongings. However, they have to live according to these commandments and regulations, which were formulated time and again during the Islamic history, starting with the Shurut al-Umariya, means the Umar terms under which Jews and Christians can live in the Islamic state, as al-Zimma, as people who live as Zimmis under the Islamic rule.
Wow. This may seem like a silly question, but when you say As-salamu alaykum, I understand that's translated as peace be upon you. How are we to understand that expression?
Literally, it is peace be upon you. Deep structure of the meaning of this word is Islam be upon you, but Islam be imposed upon you if you don't agree, even if you don't agree. Because salam can prevail only under Islamic umbrella. So actually, peace be upon you, salam alaikum, means that you guys should be Muslims, otherwise, okay? Or should be true Muslims, or really believers, really believers in Islam, so forth.
WSMN
and WSMNRadio.com.
The Telegraph, keeping you connected to your community for pennies a day.
When news breaks,
The Telegraph is there. When the community needs a watchdog, The Telegraph is there. When it's time to celebrate the accomplishments of our young athletes and scholars, the Telegraph is there, all for pennies a day. The Telegraph has been recognized for 7 years in a row as the best small daily newspaper in New England by the New England Press Association. Find out why one of New England's best daily newspapers is your daily newspaper for only pennies a day.
Walmart will be hosting a fall packing event, gathering care packages for members of our armed services serving outside the continental United States. To date, Walmart has shipped over 26,000 care packages to our troops. Anyone interested in donating to the cause can drop off a new soccer ball, a brown bag filled with items, or make a financial donation which will be used to defray mailing costs. Suggested brown bag packing items include patriotic items, candy, healthy snacks, and encouraging notes and cards. Please, no toiletries, liquids, home-baked goods, or fireworks. The fall packing event takes place Thursday and Friday, September 23rd and 24th from 3 to 7 p.m. at the U.S. Army National Guard Armory on 154 Daniel Webster Highway. If you or your group would like to volunteer, please email paul at moremart.org. For more information, log on to moremart.org. That's moremart.org.
Now, the New Hampshire Fisher Cats games are right here. 1590 WSMN.
Hello, Dr. Mordechai Kedar. Could you explain to us, you mentioned the commandments, the five pillars of Islam. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, the Islamic commandments have some degrees. The most important commandments are called Arkan al-Islam, means the pillars, five pillars of Islam. And they are the most important commandments which a Muslim should adhere, which are. The first is the Shahada. Shahada means testimony. A Muslim should testify time and again that no God but Allah and Muhammad is his messenger.
How many times a day?
As many as he can say it. Actually, a Muslim is commanded not to forget Allah during his life, lifetime. So one of the ways how to remember Allah is to repeat it in his heart all day or whenever he can. There is another way how to remember Allah is by reciting the 99 epithets of Allah. Al-Asma al-Husna means the nice names of Allah, which are Ar-Rahman, the compassionate, Ar-Rahim, the merciful, the Al-Wahhab, the one who gives you, Al-Ghaffar, the one who forgives you, and all these epithets, which sum to theoretically 99, more than 99. So, and Al-Awwal, Al-Akhir means the first and the last, and many other epithets. And when they use this chain of stones, which has usually 33 stones in them, they repeat it three times, so they're altogether 99 names, and they repeat these names all the time, whenever they can. So this is another way how to remember Allah all day. So the Shahada, means the testimony, has two parts. One, I testify that no God but Allah, means polytheism is forbidden in Islam. A Muslim should not believe in any deity which was, until Islam came to the world, like Al-Uzza, Al-Lat, Al-Manat, all these gods and goddesses which were known in the Arab Peninsula until the days of Muhammad. And the second part of the Shahada is on Muhammad Rasulullah, means Muhammad is the messenger of Allah, and actually a Muslim should believe that Muhammad is the seal of prophecy, and all the other prophets which were before him, Abraham and Jacob and and Isaac and Solomon and David and Jesus and Johannes and Noah and all the others were also prophets. But Muhammad is the seal of prophecy. This is why he's the most important of them all. This is the basic, well, the first basic commandment of Islam, Ash-Shahada. The Shahada has also other meanings, like martyrdom, which we'll talk about later. And of course, Shahada is also a certificate which testifies that you finished, let's say, law school or something like this. Also in Arabic, Shahada. But all of them are around the meaning of testimony. And we'll elaborate on this later. The second pillar of Islam is the Salat, means the prayer. The prayer in Islam is rather short, usually. It's the first chapter of the Quran, the exordium of the Quran, I would say. Rather short, the chapter of seven verses. And I think most of the Muslims in the world know it by heart in Arabic, although most of the Muslims are not Arabs, yet they know it by heart. I would compare it maybe to the first paragraph of Kriyat Shema of us Jews. Somehow it resembles the same thing. And of course, the function of this. However, in Islam, this Fatiha, this first chapter of the Quran, is more or less the whole text of the prayer. They repeat it. Some other verses they repeat. But this is the basic text of the prayer. The prayer differs a little bit between Shiites and Sunnis, and we'll relate to this later. Especially in the Azan, the call for prayer, the Shiites add something which the Sunnis do not agree to, and it creates sensitivities between both sides of Islam, and we'll talk about this later. The third pillar is Sawm, means in Hebrew Tzom, and in English fast. Actually, this is the Ramadan, in which Muslims fast from the sunrise to sunset, even not from the first light before sunrise until the last light is out there. And they fast, they don't drink, they don't eat, they don't smoke, and they refrain from relations with the wives during the day, and during the night they have festivities, they eat a lot, and they like really a festival day, and this lasts for 29 or 30 days according to the moon. And this actually is a whole month, mentioned already in the Quran, and it is very well kept in many Islamic societies, and not only they fast in this month, this is also a month of repentance, of people to check what they did, what they did not, to have their conduct better from the Islamic point of view. And since they leave out during the day the pleasures of the body, they are more they have more time to deal with their spirits and their beliefs, and to look really into what they did and what they didn't do during the last year, and to be better Muslims. The fourth pillar of Islam is the zakat, means the giving money to the poor people, which is an obligation of a man to share his wealth with needy people, as a pillar of Islam. It means this matter of solidarity of the society. You cannot see a poor man without helping him. You should give him from your food, from your money, or from whatever you have in order to help the needy people. This is one of the signs that Islam is not only a religion of the individual, This is a religion of the society. Means the Islam has a social message rather than spiritual message for the individual. It is some kind of conduct for the society as well. And the zakat means the tzedakah, money which you give or food which you give to the needy people. This is one of the demonstrations of the fact that Islam has a lot to say to the society. And we can see it later in other things, because Muslims are obligated to watch each other, that everyone should be the guardian of the other Muslim to prevent him from going astray and to sin. This is based on another verse in the Quran, that the believers, the men believers and the women believers are in charge of each other. They order each other to do the good and they prevent each other to do the bad. So this verse actually demonstrates this idea of Islam being a religion of the society, not only the religion of the individual. The fifth pillar of Islam is the Hajj. They coming to Mecca, the pilgrimage to Mecca once a year during the month of Dhul Hijjah, and performing the manasik, means the ceremonies of the Hajj in the surroundings of Mecca, and also it is preferred to go to Medina, another city in the Hijaz in Saudi Arabia, to visit the places where the Prophet Muhammad was active as a ruler, and later the first caliph, four caliphs who ruled the Islamic empire from Medina, and of course his mosque and other places in Mecca, including this Hajj includes also, let's say, throwing the stones at the Iblis, at the Satan, in some kind of a demonstration of the fact that the Muslim abandons the Satan and he is willing and he is sticking to Allah and to the good orders which Allah gave him. However, I must say that these pillars, especially the Hajj, include all kinds of elements which are sediments of former religions which were in the Arab Peninsula before Islam. I'll give you some examples. During the Hajj, they go to the Kaaba, to the holy black stone, which is the midst of Mecca, and they surround this stone, praying to Allah, or submitting to Allah again. This stone was an idol for centuries before Islam came to the world. And apparently, Muhammad felt that he cannot abandon this goddess named the Kaaba, so he Islamized it. You know, if you cannot beat them, Islamize them. So this is according to Islamic sources, and not only this. Muhammad's grandfather, Abdul Muttalib, was the Kahin, in the Quran, the pontifex, the servant of the Kaaba, some 40 years before the first revelation came to Muhammad. Actually, Muhammad grew up in a house of zealous idol worshippers, starting with his grandfather, who was the chief rabbi, the chief priest of the Kaaba, and it is well documented in Islamic sources that in the year of 570, when Muhammad was born, there was an attack of the Ethiopian Christians on Mecca with elephants, and Abdul Muttalib prayed to Allah, he knew Allah already, in the entrance of the Kaaba, to Allah, that Allah will protect the Kaaba from those Ethiopians who had elephants with them, and elephants were a weapon which nobody could face those days. So Allah sent a Tuyur al-Ababil, means the birds who threw stones, Hijara means sigil, on those elephants, and this army of Abraha al-Ashram, the Abraham who had a cut nose, just dispersed, thanks to the prayer which Abdul Muttalib prayed to Allah, and Allah rescued the Kaaba from being occupied by those Christians. So definitely this element of the Kaaba is a sediment, or which they in the Islam is a sediment of idol worshipping religions, which were in the Arab Peninsula centuries before Islam came to the world. And also the word Hajj actually is the word in Hebrew Hag, which is also it is a festive, but it also means to go around. And this is what they do around the Kaaba. They go around the Kaaba during the festivities. So definitely it has to do with Jewish sources. And also the prayer, the Salat, probably came from Judaism, because in Aramaic, which many Jewish sources are written in, it is actually the word Tzlota, which is the prayer. And it came to Arabic in the word Salat, which is a parallel to Tzlota. So, definitely, Islam was influenced by other religions which were around in the Arab Peninsula, Judaism, Christianity, and idol worshipping religions, as we know from Islamic religions, from Islamic sources. And this is no surprise, because Muhammad himself had a very good friend who was a Jewish rabbi from Yemen. His name was Ka'ab al-Ahbar. And many anecdotes from Jewish sources, from the Bible, from the Old Testament, from the Mishnah, from the Talmud, from the Midrashim, were inserted into Islamic sources by Ka'ab. And there is a question, what is Ka'ab wanted? Did he want to Islamize Judaism, or he meant to turn Islam into some kind of Judaism? It is unclear, but definitely the many Jewish traditions and ideas were brought to Islam by this Ka'ab, who his second name is Ka'ab al-Ahbar, means the Ka'ab of the rabbis. Apparently he was a rabbi in Yemen, and he maybe converted to Islam, maybe not. He was a friend of Muhammad, and he is the source of many Jewish concepts and ideas which were implanted into Islam.
Okay, you mentioned a lot of different words, and this is really fascinating. I'm wondering, you said Ummah.
Ummah, actually, is the nation of Islam. Ummah. U-M-M-A-H. This is, of course, parallel to the Hebrew word, Ummah. Mm-hmm. However, the meaning is totally different from any other meaning of nation in any other language. Because in other languages, nation is based on language, on clothing, on traditions, on habits, on maybe religion as well. You know, there are some characteristics of what the nation is. Everybody knows what's to be French. Okay? The French people are French. Nobody else is a French. And whatever makes them French people is what, you know, the characteristics of a nation, and in this case, the French nation. And so every other nation in the world, the British nation, everybody knows what is to be British, what it means to be British, and these are the characteristics of the British nation. Okay? We would expect that the same word will be in the Islamic discourse, but it is different. Because in Islam, the meaning of Ummah means all the Muslims in the world. They could be Africans, they could be Asians, they could be Europeans, they could be South Americans. They could speak in many languages. They could look different. They could eat different foods. They can dance to different music. They can have different habits and traditions. They can be totally different in any criterion which makes nation, which make a nation in the Western idea. However, since they are all Muslims and they adhere to Islam, they are the Islamic Ummah. They are the Islamic nation, which is based only on religion. This is why Muslims could be Iranians, Persians, Baluchi, Kurds, Arabs, Indonesians, Malaysians, Pashtuns, Urdus, Sindhis, and whatever they are. There are who knows how many hundreds of ethnic groups in the Islamic world, and it doesn't bother them. As long as they are Muslims, they are one Ummah. Means the definition of nation in the Islamic vocabulary is totally different from any other definition of a nation in any other culture.
And those different currents in the Islamic world, they have the same exactly, like you do not have a current which is more upper than the others?
A branch or a strain, a sect of Islam, a different kind of Islam. No, is one higher than the other?
This idea of all Muslims are being equal is a theoretic idea. In the implementation was never complete in the Islamic world. Since Muhammad, even in his days, it didn't really work. They, you know, Islam, in its own view, was meant to replace the loyalty of the person and the group from the loyalty to the tribe, tribalism, or to the ethnic group, or to whatever he is loyal to. Islam meant to replace it, that he will be loyal to the religion rather to any other framework which he might be loyal before. But it failed. It didn't succeed. It didn't work. Tribalism remained until this very day in the Islamic society. Ethnic groups keep their characteristics even under the Islamic rule. Persians remained Persians until this very day. And Arabs remained Arabs until this very day. And Baluchis and Sindhis and Pashtuns and Urdus and many other and Afro-Muslims, which are divided to many tribes, and Berbers in North Africa, and groups in Indonesia and Malaysia, and in the Balkans. All these still keep their traditional languages and cultures and mindset and whatever they think appropriate. Islam as a religion failed in replacing the loyalty to the old traditional frameworks which were prevailing before Islam came.
Now,
so I think this is actually the tragedy of Islam, that the basic goal of Islam, to have all the people submit to Allah rather than to the tribe or to the ethnic group or whatever other group they might have been loyal to, Islam failed in this. And they actually are more loyal to the tribe and to the other sects rather than being loyal to the religion or to Allah by himself.
WSMN and WSMNradio.com.
Ever wonder where the customers are? You know, people going in and out of stores all day long? Well, 14A Broad Street in Nashua is just such a location. Why are we telling you this? Because prime retail space is ready for you to occupy immediately. Call 603-880-0502. Take a look for yourself. That's 880-0502 and ask for Jerry. And someday you can stop wondering and start seeing your customers at your new location. 14A Broad Street, Nashua. 880-0502.
Mom, Dad, I'm in eighth grade now. That means those years of peer pressure are way behind me. From here on out, it's all about good grades and living up to your totally realistic expectations. Alcohol is probably the last thing on my mind. Like you said, I'm too young to drink. When I'm with my friends, all we talk about are current events and boy bands. We're definitely not curious about what alcohol tastes like or why the older kids drink. And do I notice when you have a drink at dinner? Of course not. Just like I haven't noticed where you keep the alcohol. Oh, and if the opportunity arises to talk to me about drinking, you should definitely continue to avoid it. And if you do bring it up, just remind me that I'm too young. That'll probably do the trick.
Real kids are curious about alcohol. 40% try it by the eighth grade. Start a real conversation at underagedrinking.samhsa.gov. Talk early, talk often, get others involved. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
Does your vision make it hard to read, shop, cook, or see the TV or street signs? If your vision can't be corrected, even with standard glasses, contact lenses, medicine, or surgery, you may have low vision. Vision rehabilitation can help you live more safely and independently. It combines training, career counseling, support, and adaptive and visual devices to make the most of your remaining vision. Ask your eye care professional. It's your vision. Make the most of it. For more information, call the National Eye Institute at 1-877-569-8474.
Hi, it's Doug Steffen. Listen to Good Day Early Mornings on 1590 WSMN.
Nashua's News and Talk.
You've been listening to WSMN 1590, Nashua's News and Talk, and this is Israel is Real. We're two Israelis putting a human face on all things Israel. We have been listening to Dr. Mordechai Kidar, a wonderful interview, which will be continued next week and the week after. This is a three-part interview, so please tune in again next week, Friday at 10 in the morning, to hear the continued conversation with Dr. Mordechai Kidar. And just, we have enough time to thank one of our sponsors today, Vern Main, the patent and trademark law firm of Vern Main and Associates, a local firm with global practice, is pleased to announce its new office location at 547 Amherst Street in Nashua, and also on the web at www.vernmain.com. That's VERNMAINE.com. So if you are looking for professional counseling, legal counseling on all intellectual property matters, contact the legal specialist at Vern Main and Associates at their offices, again, on 547 Amherst Street in Nashua, New Hampshire, and on the web at vernmain.com, www.vernmaine.com. We have just enough time to hear about our Torah portion of the week, which is key.
Tetzeh. Remembering Amalek has provided a model for the Jewish survival. For Jews, evil is traditionally epitomized by the deeds of Amalek described at the very end of this week's Torah portion, Ki Titzeh. Remember what Amalek did to you on your journey after you left Egypt. You shall blot out the memory of Amalek from under heaven. Do not forget. Over the course of time, Amalek become synonymous with whatever individual or group posed a threat to Jewish survival. The Hebrew word zachor, remembering, most often deals with the relationship between God and Israel. What are we to remember and how are we to remember? Jews encounter the divine in time and history. We keep history alive through memory, and there is only one hero, God. History has a divine purpose, and the commandment to remember Amalek is crucial. Naivety and amnesia always favor the aggressors, the Amalekites in particular. The Amalekites wanted to wipe out an entire people, memory and all. Amnesia completes that undone job. So how then do we blot out the memory of those who attacked us so cowardly? The answer is possible the following. We can never undo what the Amalekites did. However, we can deny them their victory by perpetuating that which they sought to destroy. By raising big families who are dedicated to Jewish life and Torah observance, we will blot out the memory of the evil forces who destroyed us.
Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom.
From Israel, Israel is real. To Israelis putting a human face in all things Israel. Don't forget to tune in next week to hear again Dr. Mordechai Kedar coming to us on a pre-recorded interview from direct from Israel. Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom.
Connecting you to the news of the day.
Because communication